House or the Senate of either political party who would question the need to secure the life of the President of the United States. The gravity of the Secret Service's protection mission transcends politics and is understood by both partisan and nonpartisan actors to be critical to the survival of our constitutional republic. With a mission so recognizably vital to our nation's survival, one would think that the screening and hiring of candidates to conduct the protection mission would be agenda-free. A reasonable observer would expect that candidates for Secret Service agent and uniformed division officer employment and promotion would be judged exclusively by their ability to implement the protection mission and secure the life of the president. Unfortunately, if you choose to believe this, then you choose to be dead wrong. Sadly, and for many years, the Secret Service has been sacrificing mission readiness at the altar of political correctness. I hesitated to include this chapter because whenever someone mentions the term diversity and discusses the real-world implications of applying such a loosely defined term to a specific job description, he or she runs the severe risk of character assassination by extreme partisan actors who don't care a bit about the real-world ramifications of their ideological crusades. But the issue has become so serious in the Secret Service that it warrants discussing in the hope of providing enough public pressure to change this potentially disastrous policy. The Secret Service has a troubling fascination with informal but no less real gender and racial quotas in its hiring and promotion process, which is causing a growing tide of animosity to ripple across the agency. The subject is taboo to discuss in the polite company of Secret Service management, and they will assuredly deny this publicly if questioned about it, but it is a genuine problem. And if rank-and-file agents were given the opportunity to speak about the impact on the Secret Service of this obsession with racial and gender quotas, without fear of retribution, many of them would tell a troubling tale. I know this because I lived it, and I spoke with agents during my career from different races and genders who felt that this problem was destructive to agency morale. Although it's difficult to pinpoint exactly when the Secret Service management committed, above all else, to gender and racial quotas in promotion and hiring, I first noticed it in the early 2000s, while assigned to the Long Island, New York Secret Service office, where one of my assignments was recruiting and conducting background investigations for new special agent and uniformed division officer applicants. The same pattern would play out repeatedly in recruiting, where a small number of applicants with questionable job experience and qualifications, according to the Secret Service's own hiring standards, were expedited along in the hiring process because they were non-male, non-white applicants. This was troubling because, as I experienced firsthand later on in my career, while assigned as an instructor in our Secret Service Training Academy, the results of some of these quota-driven hiring decisions in training exercises were disturbing. Note, as a Secret Service recruiter, a background investigator, an agent, and an instructor for the Secret Service Training Academy, I saw the hiring process from inception to swearing in. There was no good reason for gender and racial hiring quotas. My experience in the hiring process and in observing the promotion process as an agent was that there were more than enough skilled and qualified people, regardless of race or gender, to both hire and promote into leadership positions in the Secret Service. But the Secret Service management simply decided to take the easy way out and quietly insist on quotas instead. The Secret Service's attachment to quota-based hiring was so intense that they hired applicants for the special agent and uniformed division officer positions that could barely meet basic physical fitness standards upon their commissioning as agents or officers. Some of these recruits for the special agent and officer positions were hired despite being unable to pull their own bodies up to a bar during a standard chin-up test. It was troubling for me and many of my fellow agent and officer training staff members assigned to the academy to watch a fully grown adult professing to want to be a member of the world's most elite protection force struggle to do one single chin-up. This is not a matter of personal fitness choices or of unnecessary attention to one component of the Secret Service physical training regimen. It's a matter of national security. If you are a Secret Service special agent or an officer, and you were on duty when a catastrophic assault occurs on the White House grounds, or when an attack on the president occurs, and you're the one closest to the president when he trips and falls in the evacuation, and you can't muster the physical strength to lift him and carry him to safety, then it's not your fault if the president is hurt. This is the Secret Service's fault for hiring someone so completely incapable of carrying out its most basic mission requirements. Doubly frightening is that these cases were not isolated. During my 12 years with the Secret Service, there were numerous cases of individuals on both the special agent and officer sides of the Secret Service who were moved along in the hiring and training process despite having skills deficits that would unquestionably endanger the president if one of these individuals were to be charged with his security on a shift. Instructors at the Secret Service Academy who called attention to these insurmountable physical skills deficits in the agent trainees hired based on a quota were often either directly told or indirectly hinted at to let it go. I know of one specific instructor, an exceptionally talented special agent and instructor, who was held back from coordinating new agent trainee classes specifically because he was brutally honest in his evaluations of agent and officer trainees, and the instructor refused to let it go. The coddling of people hired to fit the Secret Service's quotas, disturbingly, didn't end with the overlooking of glaring physical fitness deficiencies among their trainees. Many of the unqualified trainees who could barely perform one single chin-up were also tactically deficient in the AOP exercises. AOP, assault on principle exercises, were training exercises where the trainees are placed in simulated protection roles as presidential protection shift members. These trainees are then put through a series of exercises, such as mock assassination attempts on the president. These exercises are often conducted using the simunition ammunition, which I discussed earlier in the book, to impart a dose of realism. Simunition rounds fire via modified training weapons with smaller barrels to prevent real weapons from being mixed in with simunition weapons. And the plastic rounds contain a colored filler similar to a paintball. We would give one color simunition round to the trainees and another color simunition round to the instructors so the training staff could evaluate, at the conclusion of the exercise, who fired at and hit whom. The benefit of training with the simunition rounds was the intense pain and welts they caused when you were hit. The threat of being hit by a simunition round brought real fear into the training exercise, and there is no coach as good as pain and fear to teach a trainee to fight back furiously. The AOP exercises using the simunition rounds were always the exercises where the cream would rise to the top. Regretfully, I was never a member of our U.S. military, but I was always proud to watch these AOP exercises as an instructor and to witness our former military members, who were now Secret Service trainees, calmly and with precision neutralize a threat in an AOP exercise without ever shitting the bed. See Chapter 9. Without being told in advance who the former military members were, it was clear to me within seconds of the gunshots ringing out in these exercises who the military veterans were. Our military does an incredible job training our fighting men and women to operate cleanly in the red zone, the fight in the fight or flight response, where the heart rate increases and precise motor activities are difficult. And it was always refreshing to see them excel in Secret Service training while serving as mentors for otherwise competent trainees who were struggling because they had never been immersed in exercises using simulated battle stress conditions. However, the competency of the military veterans in the training exercises served as a dramatic foil to the incompetency of some of the trainees hired based primarily on quotas. Some of the same trainees who struggled to meet the basic trainee physical fitness requirements also struggled to effectively mount any significant resistance during AOP exercises. Many would struggle to fight back. Others would fire their weapons indiscriminately, and at times, some would hinder the team's ability to evacuate the protectee during the exercises. Some would even accidentally shoot and hit their fellow trainees with one of their simunition rounds during the more intense exercises. If the trainees were given red simunition rounds and a trainee had a red simunition spot on his or her back, then it was clear that another trainee had fired that shot. This was all deeply disturbing to the other trainees who witnessed the physical fitness shortcomings and the tactical ineffectiveness of many of the questionable hires, and it was devastating to trainee morale. Many of the trainees felt as if there were two evaluation systems in the training academy, one for white male agents and another for quota-based hires. Again, I understand that this information may disturb many of you, and that it may rile up extreme left-wing partisans who've convinced themselves that checking a series of race-based and gender-based boxes is all that really matters in the world, but this quota-based policy had crushing effects on the people charged with keeping our president safe. Ignoring this in order to engage in an ongoing game of political correctness will do nothing to fix the Secret Service. Halfway through my tenure as an instructor in the training academy, I was told by an upper-level manager assigned to the academy that one student, who was having extreme difficulty meeting performance standards on any of the physical or tactical exercises, was to be left alone because the trainee knew the system. This manager was referring to the Equal Employment Opportunity Complaint System and appeared to fear a baseless EEO complaint more than harming a protectee by graduating an unqualified trainee. It was an eye-opening moment for me, and another example of the federal government working against its own interests in order to advance politically correct ideas. The federal government doesn't have anxious stockholders or customers to please in the traditional sense. The government takes your money, using the threat to force to back it up through the IRS, and they spend it on whatever they choose. And as long as the political insider class continues to get reelected, they will continue to ignore festering problems by allowing agencies, such as the Secret Service, to push through incompetent trainees who are putting the president and other Secret Service protectees in very real danger. Unlike the private sector, where angry stockholders or customers can force a company to change, or they'll lose their business, few people are ever held to account in the federal government, even when dangerous policies, such as choosing hiring quotas over competence, are allowed to continue. A repeated theme of this book has been Secret Service management's fear of controversy, and their corresponding risk aversion when it means confronting brewing crises. The push to evaluate trainees, at least in part, according to their race or gender, rather than strictly on their qualifications for the job, was an unfortunate example of this reluctance to do the right thing. Secret Service management fears charges of bias and discrimination, and they will do nearly anything to avoid them. This pattern repeats itself and ripples across an agent's or an officer's career, and it is destroying the agency from the inside out. Everything from an agent's or officer's initial assignment to his or her selection for a special team, the emergency response team, the K-9 team, the counter-sniper team, the Presidential Protective Division, and more, is influenced by the Secret Service's obsession with the racial and gender quota system, and nearly everyone in the Secret Service knows it. One tragic outcome from this ill-advised and misguided policy is that many high-performing, non-white, female agents and officers have privately expressed to me sincere reservations about this quota system because they feel that they will never be respected for their job skills. Many of the agents and officers view the underperforming employees, shielded from negative job action by a fear of baseless EEO discrimination claims, as a burden to the Secret Service. One of these agents, known throughout the agency as an exceptional performer, and who was a triple threat, Secret Service jargon for looking the part, acting the part, and talking the part, expressed to me many times the grave concerns he had with quota-based hires being placed in critical assignments close to the president. Many of the quota-based hires were not only pushed through the Secret Service Academy, but they were also prioritized in their career development and placed in hard-to-get assignments, such as the PPD, despite having severe deficiencies in their abilities to perform the tasks necessary to secure the life of the president, and this agent knew it. The agent once said something to me, referring to a quota-based hire, that stuck with me. Blank is going to get someone killed one day. I never forgot that. And as someone concerned about the safety and security of the President of the United States, you shouldn't either. Part 2. What the Secret Service is Doing Right. Chapter 12. The Special Agent Training Program. When I graduated the Secret Service Agent Training Program in December 1999, the training curriculum was archaic. The training program is broken into four general parts: academics, physical fitness, firearms, and control tactics. The academic portion of the training program was designed to teach agent trainees how to navigate and apply federal laws, how to properly investigate protectee threat cases, how to apply investigative tools to investigate financial crimes and counterfeit currency cases, and how to apply federal statutes and Secret Service guidelines to the design and implementation of a properly designed protectee security plan. The physical fitness portion of the training program was designed to prepare incoming agents for the intense physical demands necessary to repel an attack on the president. The firearms training program was designed to teach agent trainees how to operate the Sig Sauer service pistol issued to all agents, the Heckler & Koch MP5 machine gun, used primarily in support of the protection mission, but also available for law enforcement operations, and the Remington 870 shotgun, used for breaching doors in the protection mission, but primarily used for law enforcement operations. The control tactics portion of the program was designed to teach agent trainees the most effective hand-to-hand combat techniques for use in both the protection and law enforcement missions. The problem when I went through the training academy in 1999 was that portions of the curriculum at the time did very little to actually advance these training goals. The academic curriculum in 1999 was unfocused and antiquated. It was written as a series of case studies of investigations, but the material was dated, and it didn't reflect current investigative trends. It emphasized process, mainly administrative paperwork requirements, at the expense of advanced instruction for the agent trainees on how to properly use and apply investigative tools to solve a federal criminal case. For example, the surveillance exercise, which was obviously supposed to teach agent trainees how to surveil a criminal suspect, was little more than an exercise in following a Secret Service staff instructor around the Annapolis waterfront while he or she shopped for cigars or clothes. I remember thinking to myself during the exercise how majestic the views were from the dock in downtown Annapolis as I stared at an instructor pretending to be a criminal suspect, while he was also pretending not to notice me. More important, I was also thinking, what the hell are we doing here? Following a pretend bad guy around Annapolis, while we both pretend not to recognize each other, with little hard instruction on the proper way to conduct surveillance, was a microcosm of most of the academic portion of the training program in 1999. If you asked the dreaded, "Why are we doing this?" question about much of the academic portion of the training program, you would get a similar answer, despite learning little about how to be a criminal investigator, because that's the way we've always done it. The control tactics training wasn't much better, and it left trainees ill-prepared for a physical confrontation. The Secret Service was teaching its agents and officers a modified version of Aikido and traditional Japanese jiu-jitsu, which it called Desmonics, after the instructor who developed the program years prior. The program was a failure by modern standards of hand-to-hand combat science, and mainly taught students how to roll and fall properly without smashing their heads into the concrete. But Aikido-type techniques, while potentially street-usable after decades of training, are virtually useless in a law enforcement academy with just hours of instruction a week for just a few months. However, the program was good for comic relief in the stressful training environment. There were some incredibly athletic and accomplished agents in my training class who excelled at firearms training, academics, and in the tactical exercises, but some of them could not figure out, regardless of how many times they tried, how to forward roll the Desmonics way. It became an exercise in laughter control, not control tactics, each time we would start the class with a series of forward rolls on the heavily padded law enforcement blue floor of the control tactics building, and the forward roll challenged students would plunge themselves face first into the mats. They would get up and slap themselves in disapproval as we all tried our hardest not to laugh. We all knew it wasn't funny watching these trainees struggle with this senseless technique, but it's an almost undeniable human instinct to laugh when someone literally jumps into what he or she thinks is going to be a graceful Aikido roll, and it winds up morphing into a belly flop, into a waterless pool. Humor aside, this was a silly and unnecessary training regime. The essence of law enforcement-focused hand-to-hand combat techniques is to learn to control a suspect until you can either handcuff him or control him physically until help arrives. The goal is not to teach the agents to be professional stunt performers or Golden Gloves boxers. But that's exactly what the program was trying to do. The Control Tactics boxing program was even more counterproductive. When we weren't learning how to roll around on the floor, we were learning how to box. Teaching basic boxing techniques to law enforcement trainees may sound sensible, but it isn't. If you approach a suspect for an interview or in an arrest situation, and the suspect assumes a boxing or fighting stance, then an armed law enforcement officer should supersede this level of force by the degree necessary to overcome it. The law enforcement officer or agent has no legal obligation whatsoever to match the level of force first before superseding it. For example, if a suspect takes a fighting stance and becomes physically aggressive, the Secret Service, along with most other law enforcement agencies' use of force guidelines, allows agents to use their handheld extendable batons to fight back. The use of force guidelines, for common sense reasons, do not require an agent to engage in a prolonged hand-to-hand boxing match before taking out his or her baton to use in self-defense. Another example would be a suspect attacking an agent with a knife during an altercation. The use of force guidelines allow an agent in this deadly force scenario to immediately use his or her firearm to defuse the situation and to stop the deadly attack against him. Again, the agent is not required to first match the force level by engaging the suspect in a knife fight. This seems to have escaped the early designers of the Control Tactics training program, who spent inordinate amounts of Control Tactics class time on teaching agents how to box. I struggled at the time to think of a good reason to teach this incredibly difficult skill to law enforcement officers. I was a boxer at the time, and I trained at a gym called Knockout Fitness. And I couldn't help but think, I've been at this boxing thing for years, and I'm still not very good at it. Yet the instructional program designers thought they could train the agent trainees to be street-effective boxers in a few months? It was backwards thinking. Worse, as the training program came to a close, they would have the trainees spar with each other. This was an incredibly irresponsible approach to hand-to-hand combat training. No credible boxing trainer would allow even a junior boxer into the ring for sparring sessions without mastering the basics first. Yet, the trainees, with zero experience ever being hit or hitting someone else, were told to give it a go. Yes, the results were exactly what you would expect. It wasn't uncommon for trainees to get knocked out cold or for some to go to the hospital. Imagine for a moment what it must be like for an agent trainee who has never even sniffed a fist fight, much less been in one, to be thrust into a sparring exercise with a stone-cold, seasoned street fighter trainee who has knocked out more people in the street than Mike Tyson in the ring. These scenarios never ended well. All the agent trainee with no sparring experience learned in this scenario was how to get his or her ass kicked with dignity, and what smelling salts looked like up close and personal. The physical fitness training in the late 90s was a bright spot for the Secret Service. Between the obstacle course, the weight room, and the sprint work around the training center grounds, the physical fitness program produced decent results. The Secret Service fitness instructors wouldn't hesitate back then to yell at and kick some dirt on the trainees if the effort they were putting forth wasn't optimal. This military-style fitness training gave many of the new trainees an edge. There's a reason training academies and military boot camps looking to imbue their trainees with a mental edge use stress and discomfort in their training programs. The act of yelling at and causing both emotional and physical discomfort for trainees places them in the physiological red zone. Learning to operate and carry out the Secret Service protection mission with your heart racing and your lungs screaming for air, while being screamed at and pushed to your physical limit, was the primary focus of the fitness program, and the instructors carried out the mission with laser-like precision. The firearms training during my time as an agent trainee was outstanding. When I joined the Secret Service, I was already familiar with firearms due to my training as a New York City police officer. But I was pleasantly surprised to see that the Secret Service had a different outlook on firearms training. The NYPD firearms training taught firearms competency, not firearms excellence. But the Secret Service didn't have that luxury. Granted, the logistics were not in the NYPD's favor, as their police academy classes could number in the thousands of new police recruits, while the Secret Service had a maximum of less than 50 trainees per class. But the Secret Service had no room for error. They drilled into us from day one of training that we were accountable for every round fired from our pistols. This may seem obvious in a law enforcement training academy, but it meant a lot more to the Secret Service. The Secret Service places men and women just inches away from the President of the United States, and in the unfortunate circumstance that a firearm has to be used to defend the President, it must be done with extreme precision and barrel discipline. Firing a weapon in an exchange of gunfire in an altercation on an empty street with a hardened criminal is a far different scenario from firing a weapon at a crowded event with tens of thousands of people on a rope line and with the President inches from your weapon. And while the concern for innocent bystanders is no different for a local police officer or a Secret Service agent, the environments they are likely to encounter during a deadly force interaction are far different. There is virtually no scenario a Secret Service agent in a protective capacity will encounter where there aren't hundreds or thousands of innocent bystanders surrounding the agent. It's a natural part of protecting the most targeted human being in the world. Therefore, precision shooting is critical. One of the courses that we as new agent trainees had to pass in the initial weeks of training was designed to teach this critical firearms discipline. The course sounds easy, but skilled shooters from both police departments and the military would routinely come up short on the course, having to shoot the course multiple times in order to pass. The course of fire was from the standing position, with the target 15 yards away from the shooter. You were given nearly unlimited time to shoot the course, but the target was no larger than a small microwave pizza, and just a few misses outside of the bullseye of the target was enough to fail. Maybe it was the extended timeline that caused most of us to stress out over each round, but I recall bringing my Sig Sauer-issued firearm up to eye level to place the shot three or four times before actually firing the first shot. Looking to the left and right of me, it was clear that my fellow agent trainees were doing the same thing, as the clear lack of a restrictive time limit on the training course made us all hyper-attentive to each detail of the upcoming shot. And while this course was designed to be more of a test of the psychological component to shooting than the physical component, the other firearms courses were designed to test our tactical abilities to shoot the shotgun, MP5 machine gun, and pistol under pressure. Some of the courses required us to sprint about 200 yards from the fitness facility on the training campus to the outdoor range, and to then pick up a series of firearms while engaging moving targets, all while firearms instructors were screaming in our ears. Although the targets were paper, they were on a horizontal track, which allowed them to move rapidly from side to side. Complicating the course of fire was the placement of friendly targets, targets that pictured civilians without weapons, placed strategically along the horizontal track. If you hit them as you tracked and fired at the bad guy target, you would fail the course of fire. Doing all of this while sucking wind through our lungs because we'd just sprinted 200 yards to the range was difficult, but it drove home for many of us the difficulties of firing at and hitting a target at a distance, while physiologically operating in the physiological red zone during an attack on the president. Their commitment to fixing the shortcomings of the training program, unlike some of the other managerial deficiencies within the Secret Service, was impressive. I was assigned to the New York Field Office Protective Intelligence Squad in the early 2000s when I saw a special agent job opening in the James J. Rowley Training Center for a control tactics instructor. I only had a few years of experience as an agent at the time, but I inquired about the position. I found out that the training staff at the training center were looking for someone from the field office to transfer to the training center who had experience in ground fighting and Brazilian jiu-jitsu. At the time, I was training in a ground fighting school in Long Island, New York, and I was one of the few applicants for this position who had the experience they were looking for. The Secret Service was prescient in seeing the need for this type of training in the early 2000s, as most law enforcement academies were still teaching boxing as their primary form of hand-to-hand combat training. But the explosive growth of the Ultimate Fighting Championship and the corresponding growth in the number of ground fighting and Brazilian jiu-jitsu schools around the country garnered the attention of instructors in the Secret Service Academy. As a result, they were eager to begin the transition from boxing to ground fighting. This move made sense from a practical perspective. If a suspect takes a fighting stance in an altercation with an agent, then the agent is trained to move up the force continuum until the subject is subdued, not to get involved in a boxing match. But if an agent is attempting to arrest a suspect, and the suspect tackles the agent, opportunity is limited to take out a baton or firearm to fight back. The decision to move away from boxing, and to train agents to fight back using ground-based fighting techniques, inspired by Brazilian jiu-jitsu, was a brilliant move that has paid enormous dividends. Many of the instructors, inspired by the effectiveness of the ground-fighting training, eventually took up training outside of the workday and have subsequently passed on their newfound expertise to the later Secret Service trainees. The training staff even had a Wednesday night fight club training session after hours in the basement mat room of the training center, where I and members of the training staff would get together and basically beat the crap out of each other while fine-tuning the latest ground fighting techniques. These Wednesday fight club sessions were invaluable. I learned more in those marathon ground fighting sessions in the fight club than I did in years of training outside of the training center. The management staff at the training center took this open-minded approach to the redesign of the control tactics program, and to their credit, they applied it to other components of the training program as well. The academic training in investigative tactics was clearly broken at the time. It used outdated case studies that only taught agent trainees what the agent who had worked the case 10-plus years ago had done, even if he or she had done it wrong. Although I was transferred to the training center to teach in the control tactics section, I only spent a few weeks there. The investigative tactics section was short instructors at the time, and I agreed to temporarily fill in there to ease the manpower strain. The temporary assignment quickly turned permanent when the supervisor of the section and I hit it off. Don was an excellent supervisor who had served as an agent in the Vice Presidential Protective Division, but he never held a grudge about it. There was always a healthy tension between the PPD agents and the VPPD agents, mainly because the PPD was considered the A-team within the Secret Service, and the available spots there were limited. As a result of the limited openings, a number of qualified agents, hoping to be assigned to the PPD, were forced over to the VPPD, and some remained bitter about it, even years later. That was unfortunate, because some of the best agents I worked with during my tenure with the Secret Service were VPPD agents. The VPPD agents had an expression. We do more with less. And they were correct. The threat level to the vice president isn't that much different from that of the president. Yet the VPPD agents were always struggling in the fight for limited protection assets. Whether it was magnetometers, uniformed division officers, or post standers, special agents not assigned to the PPD or VPPD, but taken from the field offices to support the protection mission, they were always fighting with headquarters to get the assets they needed to accomplish the mission. This constant struggle for assets forced the VPPD agents to be extra creative when designing their security plans. And it showed when many of them were later promoted because they carried over much of this creativity and outside-the-box thinking to their new managerial assignments. The tension between the protective details still remained, though, as some of the agents on the PPD, when I was there, would joke around and say, "No one comes to the Secret Service to protect number two," referring to the vice president. Don was one of those former VPPD agents who took his creativity with him from the VPPD to his new supervisory position in the training center's investigative tactics section. He had a meeting with the special agents assigned to the section early in my tenure there, and he was clear that we were going to redesign and rewrite everything. But instead of updating the antiquated case studies, Don decided that we were going to do it right. We were going to abandon the case study approach in the investigative tactics section and instead teach the agent trainees how to be the best federal investigators in the country. But to do that, we had a good bit of learning to do ourselves. Most of the agents assigned to the investigative tactics section as instructors, like me, were relatively new to the agency, and we were pre-detail, newer agents who hadn't yet completed a full-time protection assignment. Therefore, our collective experience was limited. To overcome this skills deficit, along with the deficits in the training program, we undertook a bold initiative to reach out to the federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies that had a reputation for excellence in specific investigative tactics and ask them for help. Not knowing where to start, a few of us began cold calling agencies such as the Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA, and some of the federal government's intelligence agencies, and asking them if we could sit in on their training. It took a few rounds of follow-up phone calls to get to the decision-makers, but thankfully a number of the agencies were gracious and agreed to either let us attend their academies or to assist us themselves in redesigning our own training program. Two standout agencies who contributed greatly to this effort were the DEA and the military intelligence community. The DEA has a body of experience in undercover operations second to none. Their agents are constantly putting themselves in severe danger by going undercover to buy illegal drugs and contraband in order to further their investigations, and one small mistake could quickly cost them their lives. When the DEA agents agreed to join us at the Secret Service Academy to train us, the instructors, they brought with them a series of disturbing videos of undercover operations gone bad because of avoidable mistakes. It was admirable that the DEA agents had embraced some of the mistakes they made in the past as an agency and used them as training tools and cautionary tales for others engaged in dangerous undercover work. The Secret Service does the same thing when it trains outside agencies in protection operations by using the John F. Kennedy and Ronald Reagan attacks as examples of what not to do. The videos were tough to watch. One specific video showed the outside of a house where an undercover operator was conducting a drug buy inside. In the middle of the operation, a co-conspirator who was hiding in the closet leaped out, and both suspects attempted to rip off the undercover officer. The criminals didn't know the undercover operator was law enforcement. They thought they were ripping off another criminal drug dealer. The audio of the altercation from the undercover operator's body wire is tough to listen to. Knowing he had children and was beaten within inches of his life was a rude awakening to just how dangerous undercover operations are. When the video ended, we were all dead silent. Not a word was said. Our stares did all the speaking, saying, "Did that just happen?" It reminded us all about how irresponsible it is to teach subpar tactics to agents who could be endangered by them. Candidly, we had been teaching little about tactics and a lot about paperwork and administrative processes, when in the real world, it's bad tactics that could get our agent trainees killed or injured, leaving their children without parents. We were so focused on the administrative paperwork process in the training program that we lost the forest for the trees. It's really not that big of a deal when an agent forgets to sign an evidence analysis request to the Secret Service Forensic Services Division. Paperwork mistakes can be corrected, but mistakes in a dangerous undercover operation can easily kill you. What we were committed to caring about after the undercover videos was teaching agent trainees to stay alive. The paperwork is easy in the Secret Service and relatively self-explanatory. We weren't asking trainees to analyze the quarterly cash flow statements for IBM. Besides, wasting precious training time teaching agent trainees to fill out paperwork when they could take the information back with them at night and go over it on their own time made this old approach to training look that much more foolish. Teaching the agent trainees world-class investigative tactics was clearly the more productive path to creating world-class criminal investigators. After the DEA Train the Trainer undercover course, I, along with the rest of the instructor staff, felt invigorated. With a sense of purpose, we deconstructed the entire Secret Service undercover tactics training program and incorporated the world-class tactics taught to us by the DEA experts. But we didn't stop at undercover tactics. We went on to scrap the interviewing and interrogation portions of the training program, along with the surveillance training program, rebuilding those programs using the most advanced and modern techniques. A friend and co-worker of mine, in the investigative tactics section, took on the interviewing and interrogation portion and began to research better ways to teach the agent trainees these valuable skills. I took on the surveillance program. The interview and interrogation training at the time, although it needed an upgrade, was in decent shape. Due to the Secret Service's critical protective intelligence mission, which required them to interview people who threatened their protectees on a recurring basis, the training was relatively up to date. The Secret Service management never forgot the devastating lessons of the attempted assassination of President Gerald Ford by Sarah Jane Moore, and this incident impacted their outlook toward modernizing the interviewing and interrogation training. Secret Service agents had interviewed Moore before her 1975 assassination attempt of Ford, where she fired a shot at President Ford from a revolver during a presidential visit to San Francisco, California. The interviewing agents mistakenly determined that she was not an immediate threat. This devastating judgment error served as a cautionary tale in the Secret Service Academy when I went through as an agent trainee, and again later in my career, when I returned as an instructor. Much of the interviewing course relied on techniques used by a private company that specialized in interviewing and interrogation. This company taught their techniques to various entities in the intelligence, law enforcement, and corporate worlds, and they were well respected in the law enforcement and intelligence communities for their training product. Their interviewing and interrogation techniques were clever, and I learned to use some of them in other areas of my life outside of my special agent career. They taught us how to follow the direction of the eyes of the suspects we were interviewing. If they looked upwards and in a specific direction, it could be an indicator of deception. They also taught us the rule of threes, which was a tool for getting a confession out of a suspect when you're reasonably sure about the nature and degree of the crime. In other words, if you know a suspect printed and passed $100 in counterfeit money, then during the interrogation you can say to the suspect, "We know you printed the $300 in counterfeit," multiplying the actual amount by three. And if you're convincing enough, some of the suspects will come back with, "300? I only printed 100. You may chuckle, but the technique works pretty well, and I used it successfully a number of times in financial crimes investigations. It was these techniques, combined with new material, and an emphasis on redesigning the associated practical exercises, where the students would interview a trained actor playing a criminal suspect that eventually replaced the outdated case study-based classes. Unfortunately, the surveillance program was a total disaster, and I was committed to scrapping the entire program. It was nothing more than an exercise in following people around. That's not surveillance. It's stalking. And it requires no special set of skills to do. However, professional surveillance does require intense training. It's a complicated exercise in seeing others without being seen yourself. I had to search for a while to find an agency willing to teach us how to do surveillance. But upon advice from a co-worker, the same one who rewrote the interviewing course, I settled on approaching a group of former military intelligence experts and asking them for their help. These guys were top tier and had conducted surveillance in some of the most dangerous countries in the world for American operators to work in. If they made a surveillance mistake and they were burned, discovered by the person they were surveilling, they could wind up arrested, beaten, or worse. The penalties for these men for surveillance mistakes were very real, and their techniques were light years ahead of the, "Hey, go follow the instructor to Annapolis," surveillance class we painfully suffered through when I was a student in the Secret Service Academy. They taught us surveillance techniques, ranging from using hazards, forks, and turns in the roads to your advantage when surveilling a suspect, to avoiding doughboys, innocent civilians who notice you surveilling the target, and who inform the suspect that he's being watched. They even had clever terms for suspects who would speed up in a vehicle's surveillance to get through yellow traffic lights to leave a surveillance team in the dust. They called this squeezing the lemon. But they also taught us valuable techniques for detecting surveillance on ourselves. Learning how to detect surveillance on ourselves was a skill that would come in handy later in my career on presidential protection when I was in the transportation section of the PPD and would escort the presidential vehicles from the military planes they flew in on back to the secure hotel. It always helped to use those counter-surveillance skills to ensure that we weren't being followed by hostile elements looking to see where we stashed the secure presidential vehicle package. The golden rule of counter-surveillance was time, distance, and direction. If you're followed for a long period of time, it doesn't necessarily mean you're being surveilled, because the person following you may be going to the same place you're going. If you're followed for a long distance by the same person, it may be suspicious, but again, maybe the driver is going to the same location. But if you incorporate some changes in direction, and the person is still following you, now it's time to heighten your suspicion. The course was far more complicated than this oversimplification, but I was proud to update the training program to reflect the advice and training techniques of these former military experts. My experience in helping redesign the Secret Service's training program taught me what can be done when the current alphabet soup of federal agencies combines efforts and expertise to produce a better product for the taxpayers. And, given our disastrous national debt, it only makes sense in the future for federal lawmakers and the president to be visionary and to look at a complete reorganization of the current federal law enforcement and intelligence bureaucracy. Dividing up the federal law enforcement and intelligence responsibilities among an alphabet soup of federal agencies may have made sense to lawmakers in the past who were concerned about the power of a single federal police force, but as we saw with the Susan Rice Obama administration spying scandal, where White House officials requested the unmasking of the names of Trump associates being spied on by our government, abuses of power can happen even when responsibilities and power are divided among agencies. It's time we moved toward a single federal law enforcement agency, where expertise can be shared vertically and horizontally throughout the new organization. A single intelligence agency that can be strictly monitored by Congress and can share valuable intelligence seamlessly both vertically and horizontally, and a single internal affairs inspector general who could work with Congress to monitor the activities of the law enforcement and intelligence operations to battle the inevitable creep toward power abuses. Chapter 13. Interagency Cooperation. The cooperation with outside federal agencies in the redesign and development of the new agent training program in 2002, 2003, and 2004 was an example of something the Secret Service, despite all of its recent problems, generally does very well. Cooperation. Secret Service upper-level management found it difficult to institute systemic agency-wide changes until White House security breaches and other public agency failures increased public pressure to the point where the status quo was untenable. However, the working agents in both the field offices and on protective details, by necessity, have very good working relationships with outside law enforcement agencies. Seeking help from the DEA and military intelligence operators in the redesign of the agent training program was natural for me and my co-workers in the investigative tactics section of the Secret Service Training Center, because seeking help from outside agencies was an essential component of our jobs when we were special agents in the field offices. Even the most junior special agent in the field office figures out quickly that he or she cannot design a security plan for a Secret Service protectee without the help of local law enforcement. When a special agent is designing a security plan to protect the president against threats from the Big Six threats, he must keep manpower concerns in mind when designing the plan within the three rings of security, the outer, middle, and inner rings. For example, the innermost security perimeter, which is best described as the roughly arm's-length area surrounding the president, is almost always manned exclusively by special agents from the Secret Service's PPD. With few exceptions, the Secret Service prefers to keep this inner ring staffed with its own agents because of the very specific protection training its agents go through. Secret Service agents are trained in the Control Tactics Program, how to remove the dreaded huggers and handshakers from their protectees. In the inner ring, agents deal with these problems often. People, most with no ill intent, can get overexcited in the presence of the president and other world leaders the Secret Service protects, and many of them will hug the protectees or vigorously shake their hands and sometimes refuse to let go. The Secret Service trains regularly on simple joint manipulations using the hands and elbows that will allow them to remove an overexcited hugger or handshaker from a protectee. This training, along with the rope line training, where agents are trained to focus their attention on a zone of coverage rather than on the protectee, and close quarters firearms training, where agents learn to use an extra level of muzzle discipline while working closely with the protectee, makes Secret Service agents ideally suited for the inner protection ring. The rare exception I've seen is when the president or a world leader travels to New York City. The NYPD was always terrific to work with, but they would always insist that one of their intelligence division detectives be allowed to work the inner ring with the Secret Service protective detail. Due to the different training and job requirements of the NYPD detectives in the intelligence division and the Secret Service agents working the inner ring, I never thought this was a good idea. I successfully completed not only the New York City Police Academy, but also the Secret Service Agent Training Course and the Secret Service Protective Detail Training Course. And although the training is high quality in all of these, it's different in preparing their officers and agents for their respective missions. But the Secret Service management in the New York field office and the management of the protective details never big-leagued. Secret Service jargon for cocky federal agents talking down to local police officers, the NYPD, and tried to kick them out of the inner ring. I always admired the better managers in the Secret Service and their desire to see the big picture when circumstances presented them with a series of unpalatable options. Cooperation was key to the New York field office management staff when I worked there, and the management understood that the larger protection mission was better served by allowing an NYPD detective in the inner ring, despite some training disparities, rather than big-leaguing the detective and kicking him or her out, upsetting NYPD management, and destroying the generally positive feelings the two agencies had toward each other. Learning to put your federal agent ego aside and to be a team player with the NYPD and local police departments around the country was an essential part of being an effective special agent. The middle perimeter, which is the area a protectee will walk through and bypass during the course of an event, is mutually shared by the Secret Service and outside law enforcement agencies. Cooperation in this middle perimeter is essential, and a successful security plan absolutely requires the full buy-in of the cooperating law enforcement agencies while working within it. The Secret Service often uses pipe and drape to close off the sensitive areas of its protected sites from public view. But pipe and drape is not a physical barrier. It's literally a blue sheet hanging from a pipe. It's a visual barrier only. However, with the addition of outside law enforcement to complement Secret Service agents on the outside of the pipe and drape, you now have an effective deterrent to someone straying into your secure area. The Secret Service relies heavily on outside law enforcement in the middle perimeter because in the real world, outside of the training environment, it's completely impractical for a Secret Service agent to arrest someone for trespassing if he or she strays into the secure area. The arrest would pull the agent off of the posting assignment, and it would take hours of paperwork to process the arrest. The agent would probably be laughed out of federal court if he presented a case such as this to a federal prosecutor. These are such burdensome cases that the Secret Service will often rely on local prosecution, even for trespassers at the White House, which I believe incentivizes more people to jump the fence because of the lack of a credible penalty. But the uniformed law enforcement officers in the middle perimeter, in addition to serving as a strong visual deterrent, the special agents of the Secret Service do not have uniforms, are vital because the officers can easily issue a trespass citation or, if necessary, make an arrest if someone intentionally enters the secure area without getting bogged down in hours of federal paperwork. The outer perimeter is primarily, but not exclusively, manned by non-Secret Service law enforcement personnel, and is typically the ring of security that is the most manpower-intensive. The outer perimeter consists of the motorcade route and the areas around protected sites, which require access control and eyes-on law enforcement-trained personnel to intercept vehicles and people attempting to circumvent the security fencing or temporary barriers. The Secret Service, due to its small size and geographically spread out field offices, does not have the manpower to provide a special agent for every post on the manpower-heavy outer perimeter. Therefore, cooperation with local law enforcement is critical in obtaining and deploying their equipment, assets, and manpower to ensure that the perimeter is fully staffed during a protection mission. It's these critical soft skills, learning to request the appropriate assets, and dealing respectfully with outside law enforcement agencies during the protection mission that have always served the Secret Service well, while effective liaison remains a soft spot for some of the other federal law enforcement agencies. There is a tangible tension in many of America's big cities between some federal law enforcement agencies, notably ICE and the FBI, and the local law police departments. Some of this is due to the larger political environment, specifically with regard to ICE and the ongoing immigration debate. But some of this tension is due to jurisdictional turf battles, the lack of information sharing, and sometimes just plain old big leaguing. The Secret Service doesn't have the option of starting fights with local law enforcement about petty jurisdictional fights or information sharing because the Secret Service cannot do its job without outside law enforcement help. Outside law enforcement provides the Secret Service with critical intelligence about local crime trends, an essential component of any protective intelligence advance in any of the locations the president or another protectee visits. Stolen police uniforms, always a significant threat in the Secret Service because of the access they provide, and essential manpower to secure posts in the middle and outer perimeters. This forces junior agents to learn the soft skills necessary to gain cooperation from their local law enforcement partners, and it has given the Secret Service a generally strong reputation among the nation's law enforcement agencies. I still receive positive emails and social media connections from law enforcement officers across the country, extolling the virtues of the Secret Service agents they worked with when the president or a world leader visited their city or town.